Okay, and now we're going to have our show with investigative mythologist William Henry. We'll talk about some of his work, including Soul Rising. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. William Henry, let's talk about some of your work out there in Egypt. You had a very productive tour going until this mess, didn't you?
I did. I was working on several fronts. I always do presentations in Egypt because they try to keep the non-West or non-Egyptian guides from talking in the temple. So I'll cover things in my lectures and presentations, which were focused on three key points. First, Egypt is a legacy civilization. In my research, it's traced all the way back to beings they call the Aku, which are the glorious ones, the light beings, as they're described. And so we can think that we're either talking about literal, ephemeral light beings, like angelic-type beings, or way people think of angels, or wise sages. And I happen to think that we're dealing with a super-advanced civilization with technology perhaps even beyond our comprehension that created the Egyptian civilization. And second, the ancient Egyptians were obsessed with the quest for immortality or the secrets of eternity. And then the third point I was making in researching was one that I've been on for a while, which is that Christianity is the Egyptian religion. That in fact what's happened is that the esoteric secrets of Christianity are found in ancient Egypt. The roots of Christianity are found in ancient Egypt. And so by following those three paths, I'm looking for ultimately where did we come from? These light beings? How did we get here, and how do we transform ourselves into this next level of human that everybody's talking about is on the verge of manifesting?
Tell me about your work with winged serpents.
Well, this was something I've been kind of segueing into in the past year or so. I've been researching the seraphim, who are the highest order of angels in the Judeo-Christian tradition. The word seraph or seraphim means fiery or winged serpent. Just like, for example, the Mayan savior figure Quetzalcoatl's name also means feathered serpent or winged serpent. Well, in ancient Egypt, in the temples, I was finding example after example on the temple walls of imagery featuring these winged serpents. And I watched this transition of how the winged serpents of ancient Egypt would morph into the images of the winged Isis in particular, and I'm seeing this transition occur and just documenting that, wait a minute, these seraphim that were talked about in the Old Testament and the New Testament were actually present in ancient Egypt, and they may in fact be this super advanced race of beings that the ancient Egyptians said were responsible for founding their civilization.
These winged serpents that you found everywhere. Could they have been ETs as well?
I think that they are a logo or a symbol for this extraterrestrial race, yes, of, again, super advanced ephemeral light beings.
Light beings.
The Aku, the glorious
angelic?
Ones.
Angelic?
Yes, we think of them as the highest order of angels in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And when we start to look at it from this way, it's saying, well, what is the possibility that we have for transforming into one of these beings? Because for the past year, I've been cataloging these images of Jesus as a seraph, as a winged Christ angel. When he appeared to St. Francis in Assisi, he appeared as a seraph. And there are other examples. In the Coptic Church, the Egyptian Christian Church in Aswan, I took photos of the crucifixion of Jesus with a seraph just above the cross of crucifixion. And this is all going to this research that I've been doing that says that these beings, these seraphs, these winged serpents, are in fact a very advanced race of beings who may even be transformed humans. And I have to tell you, George, I got a huge blast of energy just before I went to Egypt from a book called Revelation of the Magi by a Harvard professor named Brent Landau, who translated for the first time ever in English a 6th to 8th century text called The Revelation of the Magi. It tells the story of the three magi going to visit the Christ child. But the twist in this text says that Jesus, they weren't following a star. They were following a star child. Jesus was a star man, a light being, who manifested before the magi in a cave through a gate. And when I read this, I'm saying, well, this is exactly what my research has been leading to, this idea that Jesus is a Stargate-traveling time traveler. In fact, he says in the Revelation of the Magi that he appears everywhere all at once. He's appeared in numerous civilizations apart from what we think of as the early Christian era. And it goes to this idea that Jesus is one of these light beings. He's literally called a star child, a star man, in this text, and it's been buried in the Vatican Library, and if not for Dr. Landau recovering it, we might not have known anything about it.
The Secrets of Tutankhamun, tell me about that. What happened?
Oh, this is an amazing story of my new passion. My wife's father and grandfather were friends with Lord Carnarvon, who was the financier of Howard Carter, who discovered Tutankhamun's tomb. They were invited by Lord Carnarvon for the opening of Tut's tomb.
That was in 1920?
In 1922.
Okay.
Yeah, Claire's father was 50 years old when she was born. Or excuse me, he was older than that. He was in his 60s. Her mother was 49. And he brought Claire up, brought my wife up, always telling the story about being there and experiencing the tomb firsthand. In fact, her father twice tried to enter the tomb of Tutankhamun and was knocked out by some kind of energy. He touched a scarab, he would say, on the wall.
Well, there was a curse, wasn't there?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So Claire has a family album of never-before-published photos of the opening of Tut's tomb. So we've been researching that, getting a hold of that album. Claire's, of course, a believer in the curse of Tutankhamun. She's kind of experienced it herself when we went into the tomb of Tutankhamun together last year. And so we're researching all of this aspect of it and getting ready to start writing our book about the secrets of Tutankhamun, the ascension of Tutankhamun, and to present these never-before-seen photos. In fact, in April, we're going to be in England. We're going to go to Highclere Castle, which is the estate of the Carnarvon family, to meet with the Earl, the present Earl of Carnarvon, to work with their archives and show that here's Claire's family in these photos with Lady Evelyn, and who is the daughter of Lord Carnarvon. She was the first one to enter into the tomb. And part of what Claire is hoping to do is she recognizes that her family was sort of an aristocratic British family, mm-hmm. as were the Carnarvons. And it was common for them to, there's no question that as Claire's father said, that Howard Carter was naughty. That, in fact, there are a huge number of objects that are missing from Tutankhamun's tomb. Yeah, without a doubt. There's no question this has happened. And Claire has a sense that maybe her family was given an object or two. She was trying to get a hold of that, and she wants to return it to Egypt. She believes that these objects need to be returned to Egypt, and she's hoping to use whatever influence she could possibly have, if any, to say to the Carnarvon family, we know the Carnarvons have stuff too. And they have it, in fact, on display at Highclere Castle. And that she just feels that it's time for these objects to be returned to Egypt. And she's hoping that some of the other aristocratic families of England and elsewhere and some of the collectors that were given these items by Carter. In fact, Carter's daughters, when they went to his apartment in London, said it was obscene what Howard Carter had hauled out of Egypt and was keeping out of the public eye. And we're just hoping that now will be a time when these objects can be returned to Egypt and can be shared with the public, because truly, Egypt doesn't belong to Egypt. The pyramids are a World Heritage Site. These objects, these monuments, these temples, in fact, belong to the whole world. And this is why the world has to be concerned about what's going on in Egypt, because it's our legacy, it's our history that is in jeopardy here. And so part of what we're trying to do is research out these lost secrets of Tutankhamun, seek out in any way we can some of the objects that are missing. There were 5,000 objects recovered from Tutankhamun's tomb. And you look at the masterpieces that are in the museums and you just wonder what else could be out there. Did they take the cream of the crop for themselves and sequester it away in these country estates in England and France and elsewhere? And where is this stuff? What is it? And can we get it?
I've always believed that these investors and these megabuck people have these artifacts. They might even have the Ark of the Covenant somewhere.
They very well could, George. And that is part of what I see happening in Egypt right now, especially with Zahi Hawass. I mean, he is on a campaign, just like Saddam was on a campaign to recover these artifacts. And in fact, Zahi is requesting not only that the Nefertiti bust in Berlin and the Dendera Zodiac and the Louvre and the Rosetta Stone be returned, but he specifically and prophetically wants the obelisks that are in Paris, London, and New York, the same ones that Saddam Hussein was after, returned to Egypt. And I agree with Zahi. It's time for the items, the objects that were pillaged by these tomb robbers to be returned to Egypt and, in fact, returned to the world.
You were in Abydos, and that etching still boggles my mind. Is that where it still is, where flying saucers and submarines and all that?
The submarine, the helicopter, yeah, it is truly mind-boggling.
How big is that?
Well, first of all, it's on a pediment that is about, I'd say, 40 feet up in the air. It's close to the ceiling. And each of the glyphs is probably about, about 8 to 10 inches wide by 4 inches tall, let's say. So you can see them with the naked eye. It's even better if you've got a telephoto lens in your camera. And it does. It befuddles you when you look up there. You instantly recognize that's a tank, that's a helicopter. It seems to be.
There's no question. And when was this made?
We're talking the time of Moses, middle of the 14th century B.C.
How could anybody look at those objects, William, and not say it's a plane, it's a craft, it's a helicopter? It's obvious.
It is to our modern sensibilities. And, of course, this is where the traditional Egyptologists say, oh, you can't apply modern logic, modern imagery, modern concepts to the ancient world. I say, as my wife would say, bollocks to that. If it looks like that, then potentially it is. And I've been doing my own investigations into the incredible imagery on the ceiling at Dendera, which they've been cleaning these past few years and revealing this just powerful imagery of these gods, these transformed gods who are told have now become light beings, sailing on what they call the Ark of the Millions of Years, or the Ship of Eternity. And when you take in the imagery, the ancient Egyptian imagery of the Ship of Eternity, and put it beside a modern drawing of a wormhole, they match precisely. And what I suggest is what this is telling us is that this super advanced race of light beings that the ancient Egyptian texts say founded Egyptian civilization were Stargate traveling time travelers. They could access wormholes. They could open wormholes, and they left us keys for doing so ourselves. And as we advance as a civilization and recover these secrets, it solves all of our problems and gets us beyond the boundaries of Earth into a truly star traveling civilization.
Tell us a little bit more, William, about these wormholes of Dendera.
That is, again, that's the key place where we see this wormhole imagery. Dendera, the Temple of Hathor at Dendera.
And where is Dendera, then?
Dendera is in Upper Egypt, which means it's down south. It's out in the country. It's about 60 kilometers from the city of Luxor, is on the Nile. Dendera was brand new. The Temple of Hathor at Dendera was brand new at the time of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And I'm convinced that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were both there. And what we find there is these amazing scenes showing the ascension and resurrection of Osiris. We see the gods on their ships of eternity sailing on the ceilings. We see what I think of as the ultimate keys to the ancient Egyptian civilization and our present-day awareness that we're dealing with this super-advanced race.
I want to talk about 2012 with you when we come back in just a moment, William, but you're going to be at Conscious Life this weekend, right?
Yes, I'm going to be in Los Angeles this weekend talking about my Soul Rising presentation on Sunday.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about that.
Soul Rising is one of it's the most exciting research I've ever been involved with. It's a collection, really, of some of the most profound artwork showing the ascension and transformation of humans into light beings. Basically, the artists who create this art say that we become what we see. And by meditating on and focusing on and concentrating on this artwork, it has an energetic effect on us. So I started collecting all this art, this imagery of the Tibetans in their rainbow body, these profound images of Jesus and the crucifixion where he's transforming into a being of light. We now know because he was a star child, according to the revelation of the Magi, and putting together in a collection of in this presentation. And what I've been getting back from people is that it really works. I started noticing in my live presentations is that as people were seeing this art on the screens, they started just smiling and beaming and getting excited about what they were seeing, as if deep within themselves something was being activated. And in fact, that is what happens with the Soul Rising presentation, is that as people start interacting with this artwork, it speaks directly to their soul and causes it to rise. It causes the frequency of the soul to rise. And my hope and objective is that we'll start wearing our souls on the outside instead of the inside. It seems that our culture is focused us to wear this sheath or covering and protect our souls, when in fact we need to be wearing our souls on the outside these days rather than on the inside. And so Soul Rising is just designed to help people to connect and feel the energy of their soul and to begin to operate from a more soul-based basis.
These light beings kind of remind me again of this movie I talk about a lot called Knowing with Nicolas Cage. Did you see that?
I did, yeah.
Same thing, yeah. Right at the end. Light beings, that they're there.
Yeah, they've always been with us. Call them the glorious ones, the resurrected ones, the righteous ones, the light beings, the Aku. They've been here since the beginning. They're encouraging us on this path, and they're manifesting all over the world right now. I say that based on the number of emails that I get from around the world of people that are not only encountering them in meditation, but also believe they are literally photographing these beings. In fact, I include a photograph of light being that a member of my tour took in the temple at Karnak a couple of years ago. It's virtually unmistakable that that's what we're dealing with here, is this race of beings.
And this is this what the Bible has written?
This is what the Bible has written. When in the transfiguration of Jesus in particular, when he talks about, when he takes the disciples up to the mountain and reveals himself as a being of light, he transfigures is the word the Bible uses. He changes his form. He metamorphoses into a being of light and then back into flesh. After the crucifixion, Jesus appeared more than a dozen times to the disciples in a light being form. They're called the Shining Ones. They are able to toggle back and forth between the worlds. They're in the Old Testament, they're in the New Testament, and they literally are, I believe, that the next level of humankind. They are what we are all trying to become. It's our quest to transform or morph into these light beings.
William's website, williamhenry.net, where you can look at all the things he's done, his DVDs, his books. Soul Rising, is that out yet?
Yes, it is. It's available on DVD, and in fact, I've got an 11x17 book that's available of some of the real key artwork that shows this ascension process for people to meditate on or to frame.
Where are you traveling after Conscious Life?
Oh gosh, I'll be in Memphis, Tennessee. I've got Denver, Colorado coming up in March. Actually, Golden, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
April 1st, I've got my new event in Nashville called The Anointed, which focuses on the galactic energies that are coming upon the planet right now. Then after that, I've got an Italy tour, which I'm very
Super.
Much looking forward to.
Well, that hopefully will be a little more peaceful than Egypt. Huh?
Yeah, I'm counting on it. I'm hoping the whole world goes to stability here. And honestly, we do need to put our hearts and minds together here, George, right now, and just decide we want a stable world. We want a peaceful world, because there does seem to be a force on this planet that wants to drive it into chaos.
We are overdue, William, for
a
peaceful world. We're going to come back and talk about 2012. Lots going on. What's the tie-in? That'll be next. Massive Earth changes, pole shifts. What did the Mayans know? We'll talk with William Henry about Revelation 2012 in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm beginning to think now the Mayans knew something about what's going on with the sun, the magnetic pole shifts. William, they were onto something.
Oh, without question, George. In fact, I have an article on my website about the sun It's called Solar Max, and I go into this about all the changes with the sun, and in particular, my emphasis was on the Maya. Let me just say this: when the Maya talk about 2012, they referred to this as a celestial alignment and with the center of the galaxy, and they describe it as a solar cross or as a sacred tree. And so if we think of it as the tree, then we follow their symbology, and they say that there is a serpent rope wound around this tree, which is some kind of an umbilical cord, perhaps, might even be a wormhole. That's a transportation system that their savior figure, Quetzalcoatl, uses to travel back and forth from the center of the galaxy, perhaps, because they show him riding upon this serpent rope. So you have the sacred tree, you have the serpent rope, which now we're starting to talk like we're in the Garden of Eden or something, with a sacred tree and a serpent
rope.
Might
be the same.
Yeah. And then they say that a cosmic sap will emerge from this tree. Well, that makes sense because trees, the lifeblood of a tree is the sap. But just a couple of years ago, I just took a leap in my research and said, well, what if sap, if we're talking about a celestial alignment, what if we're talking about the sap not as the blood of the tree, but what if the sap could be, say, an acronym for subatomic particle? Could the Mayans be saying that at this time we might be looking for the emergence of some kind of a mysterious or elusive subatomic particle? Well, turns out at this time at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, they are seeking the God particle, a mystery subatomic particle. But even more directly to what your question was, George, the sun has been doing some very strange things this past year. In fact, researchers at Purdue and Stanford noticed that the decay rates of radioactive elements like carbon-14 are changing. And these rates are supposed to be constant. They're not supposed to change. And so as they looked into it, they said that the core of the sun, the heart of our sun, appears to be emitting neutrinos that are affecting these decay rates. These neutrinos are invisible high-energy particles about the size of nothing. And they're saying if this is what's happening, we're talking about a huge change with the sun. Then they go even further out and say, if it's not neutrinos that are causing these decay rates to change, then there's something really weird going on, that in fact they may be talking about the sun emitting a previously unknown subatomic particle. That perfectly aligns with what the Mayans were hinting may be happening at this time. And if we're talking about this, the mutation rate changing of carbon-14, then by extrapolation, some scientists are saying that we ourselves could be mutating as well as a result of this either neutrino or yet previously undetected subatomic particle coming from the heart of the sun. If that's the case, this is all about what the Bible is supposed to be saying is going to be happening in the end times, when we will all be changed in the twinkling of an eye at the last trump, at a last tone wave or reverberation. We will all be changed to match the frequency of Christ in his exalted state, in his kingdom, as the Bible says. And when he's in his exalted state, in Christian artwork, he is portrayed sitting on a rainbow or enfolded within a rainbow because he is transformed into a light being. So when you add all this up together, we could be saying here that the sun is pumping out this new vibration or this new subatomic particle that could be having a huge impact on us. In fact, it could be morphing us right now as we speak into light beings.
Do you think we're in the apocalypse now or approaching it?
Well, I just refer people and have for several years now to go to the book of Revelation, chapter 20, verse 12. Revelation 20:12 in the New Testament is Judgment Day. It's the end of the world. Yeah. I mean, talk about a great cosmic synchronicity. If you ever wondered if God has a sense of humor, there's evidence right there. Revelation chapter 20, verse 12 is Judgment Day. It's when we stand before the throne and all are judged for what they had done during their lives. Now, in my scheme, what my research has led me to propose is that let's say that the throne that we're describing here is the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Certainly, our consciousness, more than at any time in the past couple of thousand years anyway, is now aware of and beginning to align with the center of the galaxy. We now know the sun is not the center of the universe. 500 years ago, the church would have killed me if I had proposed otherwise. But now we know the sun is not the center of the universe, that in fact our galaxy has a galactic core. And numerous shamanic traditions, ancient traditions, tell us that this is the place where our souls emerged from. So what if this throne that Revelation 20:12 is talking about is the center of the galaxy? Well, here we are right now in 2012 aligning with that galactic center according to the Mayans, and it may well be that this, in fact, is the great day of judgment, the great day of the balancing of the world, in a time when we align and harmonize with the source of our where our souls came from in the place of this immense cosmic energy that can transform us.
And it's happening so fast, isn't it?
It can barely keep up. I mean, I know people that are just, their heads are spinning, their ears are ringing with this just intense sound. I hear it all the time, and people are wondering, is this sound, is this song coming from the sun? Most people don't realize that our sun literally rings like a bell. It sings. And as Dr. Paul LaViolette and others have established, the vibration coming from the sun is the result of its interaction with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. There are energies, cosmic winds that get pushed out of the center of the galaxy, that pour through the sun, and then ultimately are kind of downstepped, if you will, into the Earth plane. And so maybe this is what we're seeing happening with the sun right now. There was an amazing image that NASA published back in November of two enormous gamma ray emitting structures bubbling out of the center of the galaxy. Astronomers have no idea what caused them. They thought, well, maybe it's some kind of particle jet from the supermassive black hole at the galactic center. They really don't know. But Dr. LaViolette says, well, here's evidence. He was on Good Morning America saying this, that this is a galactic superwave event. This is what destroyed the Atlantean civilization in his view. As this energy pours out of the center of the galaxy, it can potentially pile drive our planet, causing cataclysmic Earth changes, certainly wiping out anything that remotely resembles technology, which is something NASA's very concerned with right now in terms of their paying direct attention to the sun in hopes of protecting our civilization. But it may also be that these energies coming from the center of the galaxy can be utilized, can be used for awakening our consciousness and transforming our civilization in a spiritual manner as well. And this is the track that my research is taking me. And what I've been doing is comparing the Christian images of the Pentecost, when the disciples went into the upper room and directly experienced the radiant energy of the sun called the Holy Spirit, and it awakened them. And they're portrayed in these paintings, George, with flames coming out of the top of their heads. It's because their crown chakras, their higher energy centers in their head have been awakened, and they're receiving these cosmic rays. Well, these Pentecost images are identical to the way the ancient Egyptians portrayed Akhenaten and Nefertiti and their family being anointed by the rays of the Aton, the light that illuminates the sun. And so there is this mystery school teaching that during these times we can catch a cosmic ray, if you will, and use it to awaken and enlighten ourselves. And that's something I am deeply interested in right now. And that is, in fact, the subject of my upcoming presentation in Nashville called The Anointed. I believe we're being anointed in these cosmic energies right now. And this could in part answer why they're going into lockdown phase in places like Egypt, ancient Iraq. These are the seed beds of humanity. These are where the great ancient secrets are held. And there are forces on this planet, maybe off this planet, that do not want to see humanity succeed in its quest to raise itself to the level of the gods, or maybe even to exceed what the ancient gods could accomplish.
In Revelation 20:12, what did you mean by the eye of the needle?
The eye of the needle. This is part of what Jesus was talking about, that it's impossible for a camel to go through the eye of the needle. It's impossible, for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, just as it's impossible for a camel to go through the eye of the needle. And what it's all talking about is that just like when you go through a wormhole, the physical body won't be going through a wormhole. The matter will not be going through a wormhole. There's a spiritual transformation that is gone preparatory to entering these stargates and wormholes, in my view. And when Jesus is talking about going through the eye of the needle, he's talking about releasing all of the emotional baggage, the spiritual baggage, the physical body, transforming the physical body, and then entering into that gateway that leads to the heavenly realms. Because every single ancient tradition talks about a life afterlife scenario. In ancient Egypt, they call it the dimension of the blessed. And in order to enter that dimension, one had to go through this spiritual transformation. And this is what we see on the ceiling at Dendera. This is what we see at Abydos and elsewhere. And we have to recover these secrets of transformation and begin to orient our lives to recognize that the purpose of our life isn't to accumulate material wealth in this world and objects. It's to utilize our great opportunity we all have in a human body to transform ourselves spiritually, to cleanse, purify, perfect ourselves, is the term the ancient used, in order to get through the eye of the needle. Because as Jesus taught, narrow is that gate, and very few are those that actually succeed in going through it.
Well, we got to try to convince the Illuminati about that one, huh?
Well, exactly. And this is exactly the secrets that those we call the Illuminati have been trying to withhold from us for so long. And now is the time. And I think the time is growing short for us to really get motivated and bring this knowledge forward right now on a mass scale. It is this knowledge that will transform our civilization. So, I mean, I ask people who study the Illuminati, I mean, I could care less what Rockefeller is doing to what Rothschild. Let's figure out, let's go get those secrets that they're withholding from us that make them so afraid of us. Because once we have this knowledge, we're like Jesus. We're totally uncontrollable. We don't pay taxes. We don't have to kowtow to some dictator or some despot or some Illuminati-controlled elite government. We're spiritually sovereign beings. That's the goal. It's all about soul rising.
Well, I think what you're witnessing in Egypt right now, William, is indicative of that.
I think so, too. I think we've got them on the run. I think we've got those we call the Illuminati on the run. And they're going to try and light a fire in these places and make it so toxic that no person in their right mind would dare return to these places. But in fact, I think that's what we need to do. We need people going back to Egypt, keeping those temples alive and keeping this knowledge alive and working with the people of Egypt to preserve and maintain this knowledge, because there's so much, I feel, that is on the verge of coming out of the ground in Egypt. I believe the Great Pyramids will be ground zero for 2012. And it's just, I don't have direct evidence, certainly not in Mayan writings, but when you look at the scope of human history, the pyramids have always been there. And right now, as we know, they're building a giant wall around the pyramids. It's as if they are trying to, as I say, make Egypt toxic at this very special moment. And yet, it's Egypt's moment. It's time for this knowledge. It's time for these secrets to come out of the ground. And we're the ones that have to go digging for it.
When you did Breaking the Reptilian Code, when was that?
That was 2005.
That was way back there.
Way back, yeah. It seems like light years ago.
What was the code?
Well, the code was is that these guys knew the secrets of stargates and wormholes. As we start to elevate our consciousness and grasp hold of this idea of instantaneous travel throughout the universe, now we're becoming true players, because we're no longer talking about just kind of cruising around in our solar system in technological spacecraft. That's technology that maybe is 100 years in advance of where we're at right now. The beings that we really want to pay attention to, I feel, are the ones that have mastered the transformation into light beings and use stargate travel, wormhole travel, and time travel. That's the real gem. Those are the real secrets we want to get a hold of, and that is what I found in the Reptilian Code, is that these beings, the Anunnaki, were in fact utilizing stargate and wormhole technology, not rocket ships as proposed by others.
Well, William, soon enough, we're going to find out, because it is changing and 2012 is right around the corner.
It's here. And buckle up, armor up, and charge up is my advice for people during these times.
If you're not buckled up, will you fall out? Is it going to be that kind of a ride?
I think it could absolutely be that kind of a ride, because we could be looking at, look, if the Middle East goes nuclear, you're talking about World War III. We're talking about a major conflagration. We're talking about huge suffering on a human level all around the world. And that's a very real possibility. That seems to be their agenda, is they can't wait to drop a nuke on Iran and just ignite that whole area. And if that area ignites, you got China involved now. You've got major problems. Think about it. I mean, if World War III erupts in this way, they start dropping nukes, what do you think your grocery store is going to look like?
Oh, my God. But nothing like a war, William, to get the economy rolling again.
Nothing like a war to get the economy rolling. Yeah, it's
remember
incredible.
That.
And as Claire's mother told her, you've never lived to, she lived through two world wars, and she told Claire, you haven't lived till you've lived through a war. Well, we don't want to find that out. We want to do everything we can right now as instruments of peace to make sure that ultimate step is not taken. And I know that there are world leaders just chomping at the bit right now to take our world into this devastating path, but we have got to unite, we have got to be strong, and we have got to focus on what it is that we want as a civilization. And what we want is peace. We want unity, and we want to be able to access the stars and these star beings who are here right now galvanizing us and inspiring us.
Do you think, William, that the good people can outlast evil?
I have no doubt about that. And in fact, that's why many of us are here right now. And we're working to make this happen. There are people call themselves light workers, peacemakers. And we have to make ourselves known and transform these people. It's so easy to throw rocks at the Cheneys and the Tony Blairs and the others of this world who seek chaos and who seek war as a method for themselves to make money. But we have to send these people love, no matter how difficult it is for us to do that. That ultimately is the only answer. If this is Judgment Day, what these beings want to know is, what is in your heart? Do you have more love in your heart or more fear in your heart? And all any of us as individuals can do is to commit ourselves to having more love in our heart than fear. And as we do that, this starts that ripple effect that will transform our world.
Could you forgive someone who hurt your family? You know, somebody, you know, killed a member of your family, and just merely forgive them?
I
can't.
Well, I haven't been in that situation. I've talked a lot about my beloved wife, Claire, here. I'm so proud of her. Her mother was killed by a truck driver. And they went to court. Her brother wanted to sue the truck driver and his family, and Claire stood up in court and said, "This man has suffered enough. It was an accident. I cannot support suing this family."
Right.
And I'm so proud of her for doing that, because how do you go deep inside yourself and pull that kind of a love out from yourself to recognize
that? Well, like she said, it was an accident.
It was an accident, so you have to forgive people. So I know Claire has done it. I hope that I could do the same. I mean, I have people that I had a recent situation where I felt just totally betrayed and transgressed by a person that I considered a friend and a partner. And at first you turn the other cheek, you do react in anger, but then ultimately you do try to find that forgiveness. And that's the best we can do.
It sure is. William, we've gotten another final hour to go with you. So we're going to take phone calls about your work as a mythologist and about what happened in Egypt. Calls are ready to go on Coast to Coast AM.